Gulf Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Mark Dunley brings us coverage of Thursday's protest against the Williams Pipeline, planned to carry fracked gas into New York City. Then, on Reclaiming History, Lavonia Mallory speaks with Father Bukzak, the Right Reverend, and one of the leaders of the Russian Carpathian Orthodox Church of America. After that, on Spirit of the Suffragettes, Cassidy McCabe, our engineer, speaks with Tanya and Michael Galban about the connections between the Haudenosaunee people and the women's suffrage movement. Then we've got part two of Lavonia Mallory's conversation with Dr. Sista about pulmonary embolisms on Health Watch. And then to close out the show, we bring you commentary on prison reform from Ivan Kilgore, courtesy of Prison Radio.
But we have one important headline.
A flash flood watch for portions of East Central New York remains in effect from Friday evening through Saturday afternoon. Meteorologists warn those in Albany, Rensselaer, Schenectady, Columbia, Greene, Schoharie, Ulster, and Dutchess counties.
So I'll be inside playing It's Raining Men.
For those of you, I don't know if it's that kind of rain, Lavonia.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media right here in Troy, New York.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004. More than 700 climate activists marched across the Brooklyn Bridge on April 18th to call for Governor Cuomo to reject the proposed Williams Pipeline. We hear from Alex Beecham of Food and Water Watch, Lee Zeesh of Sane Energy Project, Reverend Billy, and Joel Cooperfen of the Environmental Justice Initiative.
So we're with Alex Beecham of Food and Water Watch at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge. Alex, what are you hoping to do in terms of getting the governor to take action on the Williams Pipeline?
Yeah, so tonight hundreds of New Yorkers are marching across the Brooklyn Bridge to send a powerful message to Governor Cuomo that we won't accept a fracked gas pipeline in New York's harbor. So we're urging him to reject the Williams Pipeline. He has an impending deadline, so by May 16th he has to act. And tonight we're sending a clear message. He needs to protect New Yorkers and stand up against the oil and gas industry.
Now, I know a couple of weeks ago at the Ethical Cultural Society, he had about 800 people giving a message to his staff person, Dale Burke, that you wanted him to stop it. Did you get any feedback from the governor's office after that meeting?
No, we didn't. I mean, you know, I think she heard the message loud and clear. The crowd was incredibly clear that they wanted the governor to stop Williams. But no, we haven't heard one way or another what he's going to do.
But I keep on hearing that these companies are saying, well, if we don't put more natural gas pipelines in, we're going to have to, you know, stop a new development, new condos. And, you know, a lot of the business leaders get very concerned about that. How do you respond to that little contention?
Yeah, I mean, to us at Food and Water Watch, it's just the complete wrong way to think about the crisis that we're in. You know, we can't afford to build new fracked gas infrastructure if we're serious about hitting any of the state's climate goals. It's time to get serious about renewables. It's time to get serious about energy efficiency. We can do those things. It's happening in Westchester. It's happening across the state. So we shouldn't fall for the industry's scare tactics, and Governor Cuomo shouldn't either.
Now we have the legislature's in vacation mode, I guess, at the moment. They're going to come back here until June. What are you hoping some of the climate change policies they might enact before they go home for the summer?
Yeah, so, you know, we think that this legislature has a real opportunity to move the state off fossil fuels. You know, we no longer have Republicans in charge of either house. We ought to seize that opportunity. And if the legislature leaves town without taking drastic action, mandating that the state swiftly move to 100% renewable energy, and we want them to move there by 2030. But if they leave town without doing that, it's a huge, huge failure. And so the next few months are going to be decisive.
Okay, and if people want to say something to the governor about the Williams Pipeline, is there any websites they can go to that gives them the contact information?
There is, yeah. There's stopthewilliamspipeline.org. That's the coalition website. They should go there.
Alex Beecham, Food and Water Watch.
I'm Lee Zishi. I'm an organizer and filmmaker with Sane Energy Project, which is a member of the Stop the Williams Pipeline Coalition.
And, you know, I know we're trying to get the governor to, you know, say no to the pipeline. any response from him so far? Or what type of arguments would you give him if he was paying attention?
We haven't heard so far. All we've heard from his staff is, you know, that they're looking into it and that he'll trust whatever the DEC says. And so what we would ask the DEC to look at is the water impacts of this. That's where they have the most legal grounds to stop this pipeline. And obviously digging up 23 miles of New York Harbor in an area where toxins have sunk below the sea surface, I think gives them lots of legal ground to stop this pipeline, because it'll definitely harm our waters.
And what are some of the community groups or prominent individuals who come out and raise concerns about this?
Well, we've had over 60 elected officials come out against that. That includes every single city council person, state senator, and state assembly member from the Rockaways. Also, city council speaker Corey Johnson, New York City comptroller Scott Stringer, public advocate Jemani Williams. And I feel like, you know, almost all the climate groups, you know, anyone who's against climate or for climate action is against this pipeline. But some of the groups that have been organizing in our coalition, in addition to Sane Energy, are Food and Water Watch, 350 Brooklyn, New York Communities for Change, Surf Riders. There's a ton of surfers out in Rockaway that are against it. Food and Water Watch, 350.org. So there's, you know, there's been over 250 groups that have signed on to our letter against this. And we're probably close to somewhere now like 20,000 petition signatures. So New Yorkers in general are just very clear against this pipeline.
And what steps will you be taking after today's event?
Well, I think we're going to do another petition delivery to Governor Cuomo. We're having a big call-in week next week to call the governor. And we'll just keep, you know, keeping that pressure up until May 16th when Governor Cuomo and the DEC has to make a decision. And hopefully on that day they'll make the right one, or even before then.
And I assume there's more information on the Sane Energy website?
Yeah, you can find out at Sane Energy's website or stopthewilliamspipeline.org.
Thank you very much, Lee. So we catch up next with Reverend Billy. So, Reverend Billy, what's your message today about the Williams Pipeline?
Well, there's just no ambiguity. There's no hesitation. This is a chance for those of us who are having trouble breaking our schedules, having trouble dropping out of our, you know, New Yorkized, you know, overscheduled lives, to change ourselves enough to be radicals, and to stand in the mouth of a gigantic fossil fuel pipeline and say no, with your body. Got to do it with your body. You know, we've learned the hard way that you can't do this online.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of standing your body, I know yesterday they had the Extinction Rebellion folks here in New York City. In fact, I guess they're day four now in London. Do you think Extinction Rebellion is a welcome new voice in the climate change movement?
Absolutely. Extinction Rebellion is really important, especially in London, where they're just, it's like coming up to the level of Mardi Gras, you know, a real costumed, crazy, it's where fun and change intersect. But I have to say that Extinction Rebellion needs to include everybody, and they haven't done that very good job at that. That's where they have to improve. They have to relax. Talking about getting out of their schedule, they have to invite everybody. Once you invite everyone, you get out of that white privileged mind, and things change a lot. Your activism changes.
Now, I've known you've been doing a lot on a whole host of issues. I remember you've been doing a lot on mountaintop removal. Is there any particular issue that you're also focused on at this point beyond fighting the Williams Pipeline?
Thank you for asking. The New York Parks Department, it's the biggest park system in the world, still sprays with Monsanto's Roundup. I guess they call it Bayer's Roundup now. The two companies have merged. Bernie Sanders calls it the marriage made in hell. And they're spraying with this known carcinogen that has like 12 or 13,000 separate lawsuits right now. It's the asbestos moment. It's the tobacco moment for glyphosate, the toxic ingredient, the carcinogenic ingredient in this pesticide. And these guys in parks, they don't seem to have noticed. It puts us all at risk as taxpayers. Who's going to have to pay for those lawsuits? People are dying of cancer at a tremendous rate, especially the farmers that handle this stuff. So we're working at, you know, we're going to the Arsenal up in Central Park, and we're, you know, the Stop Shopping Choir singing songs, you know, greeting the workers. Get with it. Get with it. Amen.
Thank you very much, Reverend Billy. So next we catch up with Joel Kupferman, who's with the Environmental Justice Initiative. know, Joe, who are some of the people whose voices may not be heard as much on this whole fight about Williams Pipeline?
Well, it's not just the protesters here. It's the guys in blue, the first responders, the cops, and the firefighters. They're the ones that were asked to put out any of the pipeline fires or spills or whatever. And unfortunately, they're not given enough information or enough protection to deal with such disasters. And when it happened after 9/11, we put them in harm's way, and then we just let them just flail and not even tell them what they were hit with. So we're really concerned that these pipelines go from the city where there's highly trained firefighters and cops to volunteer areas where these people are just basically sent in into the fire, literally into the flame, without the right protection, without the right warnings and everything else on the grounds that it's safe. And we just know that there's been history of leaks, of explosions and the like, and we have to depend on people that we don't only not to protect, but we should deny them benefits and health benefits. In Pennsylvania, I believe the law still stands that if someone gets hit with fracking fluid, right, it happens in other places, that the doctor's not even allowed to tell the firefighter what they were hit with. So you could see that in weighing in terms of what's safe and not safe, this definitely is on the unsafe side.
So have the men in blue, the people in blue, have they stepped forward and said no to the pipeline yet?
They haven't said. In some ways, they're scared to say do it. But at many, many other demonstrations, they have appreciated the fact that the Environmental Justice Initiative and the Law Project were the ones that told them what they were breathing at 9/11, and they thanked us. So I think they do have an unspoken fear, and sometimes they like come out and say it. But we just know that it's whatever they tell us, it's not safe. And even if you look at the fires in California, it was PGE under the observation of the whole state that they basically found negligent for causing those forest fires, that an outward large electrical structure couldn't be held, in the right standards.
Thank you, Joel Coverman.
That was Mark Dunley's coverage of the proposed Williams Pipeline.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, airing on WOOC 105.3 FM right here in Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady.
Next, in another episode of Reclaiming History, host and correspondent Lavonia Mallory talks to Father Robert Pujak about the truth of crucifixion through the eyes of the supposed good thief. The very Reverend Proto-Presbyter, Robert A. Bujak, is the Dean of Christ the Savior Cathedral in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, the Cathedral of the American Carpathio Russian Orthodox Diocese. You may see his live podcast every Sunday morning at www.acrod.org.
Once again, we have another exciting segment of Reclaiming History right here on 105.3 FM, the Sanctuary for Independent Media. We have a very special guest on the line with us, and we're going to talk a little bit about this very important person in history, someone who is celebrated during the Easter season, someone who celebrated during the Easter season, the Good Thief. So, Father, thank you for joining us. Tell my listeners your full name and the name of the organization that you're a part of.
Sure. My name is Father Robert Bujak. My full title is the Very Reverend Proto-Presbyter Robert A. Bujak. I am the Dean of the Cathedral of Christ the Savior Cathedral in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, part of the American Carpatho Russian Orthodox Diocese.
So listen, tell the listeners a little bit about the good thief. During the Easter season, everyone always sees three crosses on a hill, and Jesus is in the middle, and then there's one thief on the right hand and one thief on the left hand, and
yes,
that one of the thieves is the good thief. I think, yes, the Roman Catholics call him Dismas. Was this a real person from the biblical perspective, or was this just a made-up story to inspire faith?
It is a little bit of both. There is no doubt that the biblical account of the penitent thief is only found in the Gospel of St. Luke.
Okay.
And Luke's Gospel is of the four. Luke's Gospel best emphasizes the compassion of our Lord Jesus Christ to all mankind. So there is no doubt that the penitent thief was a real man. Tradition has handed down that the penitent thief's name is Dismas, as you had mentioned, which is a Greek name that means sunset. And this name is recorded in the apocryphal book of Nicodemus. Now, although Dismas is commemorated in the church calendar on March 25th, in other words, that's the saint of the day in the church calendar, it is on Good Friday that he is remembered in the section of the service with a hymn called The Wise Thief or The Good Thief. It is also written in the apocryphal books that Dismas was the leader of a band of thieves that would rob travelers in the desert. One day, this band of thieves sighted a young couple with a small child traveling to Egypt. It is written that Dismas talked his fellow bandits out of robbing this couple, who you may have figured by now was Joseph, Mary, and the Christ child, Jesus.
The thief, who later became the good thief, he's in the desert of Egypt, waiting.
He's in the desert between. Yes, he's in the desert between Nazareth and as the young couple was traveling into Egypt. He was a part of a band of thieves.
Now, is it true that the good thief from church tradition was a African or an Ethiopian or North African person?
He would have been darker skinned, not completely white Caucasian. He would have been darker skinned as most of the Middle Eastern people are. Could have been from northern Africa, in the lands of the Alexandria and the Egypt. So yes, it is very possible, but we do not know that for a fact. But it is very possible.
This good thief, why is he called the good thief? What was so great about him that he's the good thief?
He is called the good thief because of his proclamation. We will mention one thing before we talk about why he's called the good thief. We will mention that the penitent thief was crucified on the right-hand side of Jesus. As there were three being crucified, he is the one on the right-hand side. Now, in many movies that you may see here in the Western world, the penitent thief or the good thief or the wise thief is always on the right side as we would look at the three who are being crucified. So as we would look up, we would see the penitent thief depicted on the right of left of Jesus. But in the Orthodox tradition, this is exactly the opposite. The penitent thief is always on the right-hand side of Jesus Christ, to his right hand, and not to his left hand, but to his right hand. It's Jesus Christ is the center of all of everything that is being spoken about, so he would be on the right-hand side. Now, why does that make a difference, you may ask?
Yes.
It makes a difference because if we look even at the gospel account of the Last Judgment, the sheep are always placed on the right hand side of Jesus, and those sheep would be going to the ones to go to heaven. The goats, or the ones who were not believers in Jesus Christ or did not fulfill his commandments, would be on the left. And so for us, it's very important that the penitent thief is at the right-hand side of Jesus Christ.
For my listeners who, because we're not a religious station, we're a secular radio station, and I like to do interesting things when we talk about history. For my listeners that are out there and they hear all of the differences that you're pointing out, the differences between the crosses and the difference between the historian's view of the crucifixion. You are part of the Orthodox Church, and we know we have the Roman Catholic Church, and then we also have the Protestant churches. Is there any similarity in terms of the crucifixion that all of these churches share in terms of a common belief?
Only the fact that Jesus Christ was crucified. That is the one thing that we all share, that he was definitely crucified on the cross. And I think this is where the separation begins, because when you had mentioned earlier about the penitent thief, or why was he called the penitent thief or the good thief or the wise thief, it was the words that he said to Jesus Christ.
And what exactly did he say to Jesus Christ?
He said, remember me when you come into your kingdom. That is extremely significant. More significant is the reply that Jesus Christ said back to him. And he said, today you will be with me in paradise, meaning right now you will be with me in paradise. Jesus Christ died on the cross to open paradise to us again.
Go ahead. I have to, for my listeners' sake, and I can hear the general manager and the other folks who are not religious people in the mm-hmm. sense of being believers in the Christ and yes. what he did on Calvary. Are there any historians that believe that Jesus actually existed and was actually crucified? Or is this all just one big mythology that has been told over again?
A lot of people do believe that. And if you read the Bible, it says that many believed and many did not believe. And so we are asked in this life to make that choice. And that's the choice that we have to make. There are many who do not believe that this is nothing more than a myth or a way of controlling people. And so we have a choice. We have free will. God made us all with a free will. We have the choice. We have the right to believe. We have the choice to believe, accept and believe. And we have the choice to reject. Jesus Christ was definitely a historic man. He definitely died on the cross, and more importantly, he definitely rose from the dead. And this is what we believe. So there are people who reject that and say this is nothing more than a myth or a story or to make you feel good. But then again, they have that right to do that as they have the free will, and they will have to answer for their beliefs in the end. And we do not judge that. They have to answer.
So did the good thief believe in Jesus at that point when he said, remember me?
Yes, he did. He believed him at that point and even before that point. He recognized Jesus Christ to be the eternal God.
As a man of faith, as a father, as a leader of a flock, because that means you have people to whom you will yes. give account to God in heaven.
Yes.
What do Christians have to do today to live out the teaching of this man from Nazareth called Jesus Christ?
Very simple. Love your brother and sister as if they were Jesus Christ himself.
Boy, that's not so simple, Father.
I know, but it is not simple to do, but it is what we are supposed to do. It is what we are called to do. It is what we must do. We must love one another as brothers and sisters in Christ, and only then can we conquer the devil. In many ways, the church is a hospital for our souls, and it is there where we get the power and the strength to do that.
So a hospital for my soul.
For our souls, yeah, hospital for our souls. And so we go to the church when we are in need of healing for our souls. But the Eucharist, as we would say it, or the body and blood of Jesus Christ, is the medicine that we need to act and to believe as true Christians ought to.
So, Father, for my listeners again, tell them your full name and title and where your church is located and the organization that you are a part of.
Sure. My name is the Very Reverend Proto-Presbyter Robert Anthony Butchak. I am the Dean of Christ the Savior Cathedral in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and I belong to the American Carpatho-Russian Orthodox Diocese of America.
Father, thank you so much for joining us on 105.3 FM, the Sanctuary for Independent Media. This has been another segment of Reclaiming History with Mabonya Mallory. Thank you, Father.
That was my episode of Reclaiming History with Father Robert Puchak of the Carpathios Russian Orthodox Diocese, talking about the truth of the crucifixion and the good thief.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Lavonia Mallory, and you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM right here in Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. Next, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Cassidy McCabe speaks with Tonya Galbin and Michael Galbin from the Ganondagan State Historic Site about the histories of the Seneca clan mothers of the Haudenosaunee and the tribe's connections to the United States women's suffrage movement.
My name is Cassidy McCabe, and this week I'm speaking with Tonya and Michael Galbin from the Ganondagan State Historic Site.
We are the site of a 17th century Seneca village, and it's our responsibility to share that history as we've learned it from our elders and other academic Native elders and other academics, to search out firsthand accounts, of which Michael has a large library here at the Seneca Art and Cultural Center. And so Ganondagan, from 1655 to 1687, that was the last occupancy of a principal town of about 4,500-ish Seneca people, Anadawaka people. And they inhabited about 150 bark longhouses here on site on the top of this hill. And they lived here for quite a while, and they were, before that, rotating, you know, the village, rotating village life. And until the relationship with the French had gone sour because of King Louis in France had declared that beaver fur, of all things, would be the fashion of France, and of which here in this country there was plenty of beaver for a while, and the Seneca people, the Haudenosaunee in general, the Seneca, were supplying that to France. Basically, the Seneca people had to go further and further away from this village here, Ganondagan, to procure those beaver pelts, those beavers. And this took time. And as we know it, you know, in our business world, time is money. And mm-hmm. It was the same for King Louis. And so they wanted to wipe out the middleman, being the Seneca. And this caused strife. It caused a war. And so it sent King Louis to send his man, the Marquis de Denonville, to Seneca country to annihilate the Seneca, take out that middleman. Well, they were not successful, basically. They were not successful. And that's the basic story of Ganondagan.
Thank you for that. Are you able to share with us the story of the Seneca mothers of the Haudenosaunee?
So your question related to the Seneca mothers is, you phrase it in a way like there's an organization or something, or are you just, because you capitalized it in your email, I'm just for clarity's sake, are you speaking of just Seneca mothers in general, or are you referring to Seneca clan mothers?
I think the clan mothers, yeah.
Okay. So for the Seneca people today, there are 8 clans, which can be interpreted as families. And each of these families or clans is either a bird or an animal, is the designated emblem, right? So you have, in the Seneca tradition, 4 bird clans, more or less, and 4 animal clans, more or less. That's the how they see it today. It's divided into 2 groups, and they're mostly birds and mostly animals. So the bird side of the system includes the heron clan, hawk, snipe, and deer, and the other side of the system, which is primarily animals, is beaver, bear, wolf, and turtle. And so each one of these clans has a woman who is responsible for the membership in her family or in her clan, then these women are known as the clan mothers, and they, you know, bear a lot of responsibility in their community in terms of today, you know, working with any issues related to families or individuals. They are in charge of naming children, for example, and making sure that the clan lineage of the new children is preserved. This is particularly important because the leadership of the traditional Seneca communities comes from and is descended through the clan lineage. So male leaders, who in English are people most often say are chiefs, these are official titles which must be filled with the proper individuals to have a healthy and functioning nation. And so the clan mothers are in charge of maintaining the lineage, but also selecting from their brothers or sons their leadership, the chiefs, or we'll call chieftainship titles. The way that the clan system is perpetuated is that children inherit the clan of their mother, and also the fact that Seneca people are exogamous, which means they marry outside of their family. And so that means that two people who, you know, form a couple or married couple have to be from different clans. Only the mother's clan is left in the children. The father's clan is not passed along. I mean, that's one of the major functions, really, to maintain a healthy community is to organize and make sure that the lineage is all maintained and known in order that leadership can be placed in the right places, you know.
It's also their right to adopt from alien nations. Also, it's their right to forbid their sons to go enter into war. They also control the public treasury, which would be the foods, and they could provide a levy on foods for festivals, ceremonies, general assemblies, or for charity.
Would you be able to share with us some of the intersections of the Klan with the women's suffrage movement?
What we've learned, primarily through the work of Sally Roche Wagner, who really has done the most research on this topic, we've learned that the early American suffrage leadership, you know, was in close contact with Native women, in particular Haudenosaunee or Iroquois women. Well, we can just say a few instances of that intersection. Mm-hmm. At one point during a national conference, Susan B. Anthony introduced to the public a Mohawk physician named, you might even say stage name, was Princess Viroquois. She was a Mohawk lady, last name of Martin, who she introduced so that people could understand really the Native perspective. In this national conference, there was a speech about Native women and their views on American women's suffrage and how it was really, in a lot of ways, an outdated concept to them. You know, they had always they'd always enjoyed certain responsibilities and rights and never had to seek equity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, one of the famous leaders, like Matilda Joslyn Gage, she was even spending time when living in a Seneca community trying to understand what the clan mothers council, you know, where they, how they interacted with the men's chief's council and how did that all work out. She spent so much time there and was so interested in the system that the women there actually adopted her. Some women adopted her from the Wolf Clan in the 1890s and gave her a Mohawk name, actually. So, I mean, the intersections and the writings of these women that reflect, you know, the impact that they felt in learning about Haudenosaunee women, I mean, it's part of the historic record. I'll read you a short paragraph that Matilda Joslyn Gage wrote in the 1870s. She writes, "The division of power between the sexes in this Indian Republic," in referring to the Haudenosaunee people, "was nearly equal. Its women exercised controlling power in peace and war. No sale of land was valid without consent of the women. The family relation among the Iroquois demonstrated women's superiority in power. In the home, the wife was absolute. If the Iroquois husband and wife separated, the wife took with her all the property she had brought. The children also accompanied the mother, whose right to them was recognized as supreme. Never was justice more perfect, never civilization higher." And so, you know, hearing a little bit of what these women had to say, you know, once they understood Haudenosaunee culture, I mean, I think that, at least for them, was a powerful influence.
Yeah. Thank you so much. From what you've seen of the history of women's suffrage in modern movements, do you feel there are elements of the movements that embody the legacy of the Haudenosaunee?
Still continuing.
Yeah, I don't think so, in my opinion.
Okay.
I don't think so, because the organization of the Haudenosaunee people reserves responsibility based on gender. Mm. So you have a system which, you know, you might say the leadership is selected by women in particular, and women at the time had the right to initiate a war or to stop a war. I think that the way that Haudenosaunee people realized would be a benefit to them is a little bit harder, I think, for contemporary people to understand, because there is a gender specificity, you know,
mm-hmm.
and yet I think it's something else to explore. I would say to make a point of including women in decision making in a modern context, I feel like would be a great step forward, but it would take such a revolution politically that I don't know how it would pan out, you know?
Yeah.
I'll share this. It's my favorite thing to share. The closest I come to the United States government and our women, our clan mothers, coming together. And that was when Hillary Rodham Clinton was on her First Lady campaign of Save America's Treasures tour. And she sat with our clan mothers here at Ganondagan. And one question one of many that she asked that really stuck out was, well, how do you come to make decisions for all your people? And the clan mothers, they told her, one of them spoke for them, and I believe it was Geraldine Green. She said, we ask ourselves three questions, and they are, you know, will this decision that I'm going to make promote peace? And if she can answer that in a positive way, she'll move on to the second question, which is, will this decision that I'm going to make will it promote peace, or will it harm the environment 7 generations into the future? And if she can answer that in a positive way, at least Geraldine Green related that, they'll go ahead with their decision.
Mm-hmm. So that's all the questions I have. Thank you so much.
That was Cassidy McCabe speaking with Tanya Galban and Michael Galban from the Ganondagan State Historic Site.
Up next, we have part 2 of the Health Watch.
WOOC with my discussion with Dr. Sista. He is the section chief for vascular interventional radiology at NYU School of Medicine in Manhattan. And he'll be talking about the causes and treatment of pulmonary embolism. Once again, this is another segment of Health Watch. You'll be listening to part 2 of my ongoing discussion with Dr. Sista, talking about pulmonary embolisms. To my listeners, you know that last year, May of last year, my younger brother unfortunately passed away of a PE, pulmonary embolism, while playing tennis. It's been devastating, and we as a family and I personally have decided to try to spread awareness about this deadly disease. Stay tuned to the continuing discussion with Dr. Sista.
Doctor, can you tell my listeners your full name and a little bit about yourself?
Livonia, thank you so much for having me on your call. This is Akilesh Sista. I go by Aki. I am a associate professor of interventional radiology at NYU School of Medicine. In my role, if you haven't ever heard of an interventional radiologist, we're basically the surgeons within the radiology field. So we basically do image-guided interventions to heal a situation that would otherwise require major surgery. So in my role as an interventional radiologist, I've participated on teams that take care of pulmonary embolism, because some of my catheter-based skills and imaging-based surgeries are useful in the treatment of pulmonary embolism when the pulmonary embolism is severe. And as such, I've been very interested in the disease overall, and it has been the focus of my research and clinical practice. So I think that's sort of an introduction to who I am and why you're talking to me.
So doctor, tell me, what is a pulmonary embolism? Let's start there so my listeners can get caught up to speed. What is it exactly?
A pulmonary embolism is basically a blood clot that travels usually from the legs through the venous system up towards the heart and lodges in the pulmonary artery after it passes through the right side of the heart.
What happens to the heart? What happens to the lungs? What happens in that area, basically?
Yeah, good question. So after the heart after the clot passes through the right side of the heart, it exits into the pulmonary circulation. So it's no longer in the heart. It's actually in the blood vessel that emerges from the right heart. Now, once it's in that pulmonary circulation, then a couple things can happen. First of all, a person immediately feels shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, a little bit of chest pain, and the heart rate increases, so people can feel like they're having episodes of palpitations in their chest. So the lungs themselves are not that severely affected, although you can have a problem with gas exchange, and therefore your blood oxygen levels may decrease. But it's really the effect it has on the right side of the circulation. When the right heart isn't able to meet the demands of the pressure, it can't get blood over to the left heart. And once the left heart, it does not receive enough blood to pump forward, that is when your body is affected, because the blood can't get out from the left heart to your brain and your heart and all the other vital organs. And that's where the problems really get bad.
So you talked about some of the early symptoms. Shortness of breath is one. What are some of the other early symptoms that someone may be suffering from a PE?
Right. So the most common symptom is shortness of breath. So you just don't feel right, that, you know, all of a sudden or progressively over a couple of days, you know, what you were able to do before takes more effort. So climbing a set of stairs in the subway or walking 5 city blocks. These are frequent stories I hear from patients. It's sometimes accompanied by chest pressure or heaviness on top of the chest, or frankly, chest pain. Less commonly, You can cough up a little bit of blood, and then also you can feel like your heart is racing. It's often mistaken, and not just by patients, but sometimes, unfortunately, by physicians, because these aren't necessarily specific symptoms for PE. They're mistaken for other conditions, say a viral illness, most commonly, and that's where it's a little bit dangerous. So basically, that's really where we're where the most danger lies is either not paying attention to these symptoms or not recognizing that these symptoms are a PE.
So what are some of the treatments for PE? Let's say that the doctor has properly identified that you are suffering from a pulmonary embolism. What are some of the immediate treatment recommendations he or she should make?
Good question. So basically, once a physician suspects pulmonary embolism, you're going to undergo an imaging test, which is most commonly a CT scan of the chest, which will look for blood clots in the pulmonary arteries. And it's a very good test, especially with technology nowadays, where it's very sensitive to pick up these pulmonary emboli. Once it is diagnosed, and there are also some blood tests that a doctor might obtain just to see whether that whether you may very well have a pulmonary embolism. The first treatment is anticoagulation. So basically, these are blood thinners that tip your body's balance towards breaking up clots rather than forming them. Mm-hmm. These blood thinners don't actively break up the blood clots in the lung. Instead, they allow your body to break them down because they make your body more likely to thin out, to break up clots rather than form them.
Okay.
So that's the first intervention that happens. And frankly, for at least 2/3 of the patients, that is enough. And perhaps more, that is enough. Patients do very, very well once they've been started on anticoagulation. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is it possible, are there other tests besides the CT scan? Because I'm just thinking of, you know, in our insurance, you know, laden industry where people have to go for pre-approvals to get all sorts of additional tests. Is the CT scan like the gold standard testing instrument for PE, or are there less expensive ways to possibly identify a PE?
Well, it is the gold standard in the sense that it is probably the number one thing people use to confirm the diagnosis of PE. Now, in the physician's office, they can obtain something called a D-dimer test, which is basically a blood test showing how much clotting is going on in your body. If the D-dimer is negative, that's a good thing. It's unlikely you have a PE. But if it's positive, it's not 100% true that you have a PE, and you need that confirmatory CT to make the diagnosis. So yes, unfortunately, ultimately, the CT scan is necessary. Sometimes a VQ scan or ventilation perfusion scan is used instead of a CT scan, but that is less common. And so, yes, the main way of figuring this out is with a CT scan. It's my pleasure. And again, my condolences for your brother's loss. And I think that your advocacy will go a long way, hopefully, to preventing such occurrences as much as we can.
All right. All right. Thank you, Doc.
Okay. Take care.
All righty. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Once again, thank you, Dr. Sister, for joining us on Health Watch right here on WOOC 105.3 FM. For my listeners, tune in next time for part 3, when we will continue to talk about treatment options and the prevalence of pulmonary embolisms amongst African Americans.
That was my talk with Dr. Sista. He will be speaking at Albany Medical Center on May 2nd, discussing treatment options for pulmonary embolisms at a physician grand round. And for a close of our show, we have a first part of a commentary on the criminal justice system by the incarcerated author Ivan Kilgore, courtesy of Prison Radio.
My name is Ivan Kilgore, and the piece that I'll be sharing with you today is entitled "The Glaring Contradictions in the Rhetoric of Prison Rehabilitation, Part 1. I begin this piece with a quote from Malcolm X. When the people who are in power want to create an image to justify something that's bad, they use the press. And they'll use the press to create a humanitarian image for a devil, or a devil image for a humanitarian. They'll take a person who is a victim of a crime and make it appear he's the criminal. And they'll take the criminal and make it appear that he's the victim of the crime. Malcolm X. I begin this piece discussing the recidivism rate in California's prison population. In some cases, it is as high as 73%. Now, what does that say about the effectiveness of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation's self-help and educational programs? Is it simply the prisoner himself or herself is hopeless to change? Or is it something much bigger at stake that prison officials and the California politicians are keeping at bay, hiding behind smoke and mirrors? As someone who's been incarcerated for almost 2 decades, I can attest to the fact that it's definitely the latter. It's all smoke and mirrors, and the contradictions are right before you if you simply stop and peel back a few layers of the rhetoric. But no prison can rectify the wrongs of the society which had produced it. That said, the most glaring contradiction I find in the whole scheme of rehabilitation revolves around its focal point. The rehabilitative model that most prisoners encounter once incarcerated forces upon us the notion that we are solely to blame for our shortcomings and that we are to accept full responsibility for them. It is an age-old philosophy that has been getting kicked around since the very first prisons were built in Europe. In California, it began to pick up traction during the 1940s when the then newly appointed director of the California Department of Corrections, Mr. Richard A. McGee, professed, quote, the concept that there can be no reintegration except in freedom. Rehabilitation, therefore, must come from within the individual and not through coercion. With this principle in mind, the rehabilitative program contemplates not only important educational and vocational factors, but also, by and through classification and segregation, a gradual release from custodial restraint and corresponding increase in personal responsibility and freedom. Notably, there are several fundamental, if not glaring, contradictions in what that would prove McGee, as well as the department's reform rhetoric, hollow. The first being the practice and processes of rehabilitating inmates that were to ensue from that point forward would largely omit sociological factors that had proven to significantly contribute to criminal deviancy. Second, the so-called educational, vocational, and what today has become known as self-help programs that were to be established were by default aligned with the first function of the prison, which is custody, control, and punishment. Third, in terms of responsibility and the accompanying sense of autonomy that evolves with it, it is completely stripped away from most prisoners the moment we cross the threshold of prison gates. And lastly, number four, prison, by nature, is a coercive institution and therefore tends to operate against the very notion of developing one's free will to make choices. Indeed, now we do bear the brunt of responsibility for changing our lives. However, the question remains, how is it that we became these people in the first place? That is, the murderer, drug addict, thief, etc. Here, the self-help and other educational programs offered by the department do not even come close to answering the question. In fact, they only scratch at the surface. Even more, in my opinion, many of them have a demoralizing effect on our self-esteem in that they operate to enforce the notion that our imperfections are inhuman, that our addictions are self-afflicted as opposed to being cultural byproducts of social engineering. Of course, all this is said and done in spite of the fact that there are numerous sociological studies that attribute criminality to the failure of American institutions to deliver on the nation's idealism, quality education, equality, fairness, and justice for all.
That was part one of a commentary on the criminal justice system by incarcerated author Ivan Kilgore, courtesy of Prison Radio. You can find more at prisonradio.org. Guy?
Oh, no.
That concludes our show.
It's that time again.
Yeah. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I am Livonia Mallory.
And I am Guy Schaefer. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks,
thanks for tuning in.